We welcome Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer, to the line. Patrick, how are you, my friend?
I'm great, John. What a gorgeous day. Happy holiday to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a nice three-day weekend. We instinctually say happy. We know for Memorial Day it's not meant to be happy, of course, but I hope everyone enjoys it and remembers why we have the day off on Monday. Patrick, what's the latest in employment law?
Well, we've still got the FTC rule that we're following with regard to the non-compete issue. So if you recall, John, and the folks listening recall, in early May, the FTC published a final rule that effectively banned all non-compete agreements between employers and workers, stating that it was an unfair method of competition. So when they pass that rule, though, it does not go into effect for 120 days. So on September 4th, that's when the rule is supposed to go into effect, but underline supposed to, John, because a couple of lawsuits have already been filed, one in particular in the U.S. District Court in Texas, Northern District of Texas, seeking to stay the rule, essentially saying, you know, the FTC did not have authority to ban non-competes and, you know, the rule should not be implemented. So the court will issue its decision on whether to stay or stop the FTC's rule by July 3rd. So we'll know pretty soon, John, whether that rule by the FTC is going to be stayed immediately so the litigation can go forward ultimately about whether that rule can be implemented or not. So that's a really big deal right now that we're waiting for.
Let's rewind a little bit. Can you reiterate what non-competes are and what current rules there are in Illinois about them?
Sure. So each state has slightly different non-compete rules. It's a state-driven law with regard to whether folks can compete when they leave their job. In Illinois specifically, we do not allow non-competes to be enforced against anyone who makes less than $75,000 a year. That's a fairly recent rule, John, because, you know, we don't want folks in that category to be prohibited from getting a new job when, frankly, there's no legitimate business interest where a company, you know, should be allowed to prevent them from doing so. So in Illinois, you make less than $75,000, there's no non-compete enforceable against you. If you make more, then the analysis, there's a lot of questions to determine whether it can be enforced against you. It has to be reasonable in terms of geography, you know, what you're doing at your next employer, if the companies essentially do the same thing, all that sort of stuff. That's more traditional in most other states. So in Illinois, we do have that ban, though.
Okay. What is the objection to the FTC's ruling? What are these folks saying is wrong with it? Is it just that they don't have the authority to do it in the first place? Is it that they are overreaching here, that it's none of their business, or that non-competes themselves are vital to business? Or did I just give away all the answers?
Yeah, I would say the first two are the principal arguments, that they do not have the authority to regulate competition between an employer and an employee. Historically, FTC has never done that before. They've only regulated competition between businesses. And so the argument is that particular element, that is to say, regulating non-competes or competitive activity between employer and employee can only be prohibited by an act of Congress. FTC does not have the authority to do that. That's the principal argument.
If this survives court challenges, could a new administration reverse it?
Yeah, they could, because the FTC is part of the executive branch. So we could have the next, you know, president come in and simply undo that, reverse that decision and undo that ban. I don't see any reason why you can't. So that causes, there's so much confusion that could be caused by this. We'll have to wait and see, but I think those who are trying to ban the FTC's decision or overrule it, I think they have a pretty good argument. We'll just have to see, though.
Well, and I think you're getting to the point there, the idea that when you have different, you know, there's all these different sorts of parts of the executive branch, and whatever president is in office, they kind of go with those policies, at least for now. There's a Supreme Court case that might throw that in the air, too. But you could see that that confusion it would cost would be an argument for folks that don't want to have the FTC rule on this. The idea is if Congress makes a rule on it, at least it's more stable. People vote for congressmen and congresswomen. You see a direct line there.
Yeah, and I think the issue really is, does the FTC have authority to begin with? And I think there are pretty good arguments that it does not, you know, but we'll have to see. And just to be clear, John, so the FTC rule right now bars non-competes for everyone, existing non-competes. So literally, if this rule goes into force on September 4th, all non-competes will be banned except, here's the exception, except for senior executives who are in a policymaking position to make more than about $151,000 a year. Those existing non-competes are still valid. However, those folks cannot have a new non-compete enforced against them. So we have a little bit of a grandfather clause, John, for those senior executives.
What percentage of non-competes do you think are fair?
I honestly, not a high number at all. I think most non-competes that companies seek to enforce do not protect a legitimate business interest. And what they're trying to do is simply prohibit someone from working for a competitor for a number of reasons, but not ones that really protect their legitimate business interests. So I think most non-competes are do not serve a valid purpose, but certainly not all, John. I'm not going to say all because that's not the case. And remember, we have a bunch of laws that protect trade secrets and confidential information, et cetera. But non-competes, you know, serve an important purpose under, I think, fairly limited circumstances.
What percentage of non-compete complaints that people bring to you do you look at and say, yeah, it's enforceable?
Not many. I would say non-competes are difficult to write in an enforceable way, and I think even more difficult to enforce as against a person who wants to work for a quote-unquote competitor, okay? So I think most non-competes are unenforceable, and people should be allowed to work for that next company, and there's no legitimate reason for preventing them from doing so.
Patrick Dolan, you ready for some calls?
Yeah, let's do it.
Paul is on line one. Paul, welcome to Let's Get Legal. What do you got for us?
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I was working at a new job, driving a truck, and I was backing out of a parking space, and there was a car parked illegally next to me, and I sideswiped a car on my passenger side unknowingly, and I drove off, and they terminated me because I didn't have my 90 days in. My question is, about a month later, I found out I have a tumor in my head, and is that, I don't know how to ask the question, is that
like a mitigating circumstance, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you were you a W-2 employee or an independent contractor, Paul?
W-2.
Okay, Patrick, go ahead.
Yeah, Paul, I'm sorry to hear that, and that's a really good question. So if your tumor affected your ability to drive, then you might be able to assert that you're wrongfully terminated due to your disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. However, it may be difficult. I'm sorry, John, did you say something?
Nope, go ahead. Keep going, Patrick.
Oh, okay. But because the company didn't know at that time and you didn't right. bring that up to them or ask for any accommodation or something like that, that may prove more difficult. You could
I didn't find out until after I was terminated that I had the tumor.
Right. So, but if at the time it was affecting you, it's possible that it was impacting your ability to do your job, and maybe there right. should have been some sort of discussion for accommodation. But I think that would be a fairly difficult argument, Paul, seek protection under the ADA. Now, you know, it is something you could bring up to them and talk with them, because even though they terminated you because of that accident during your what's typically called your probationary period. That's not to say that you can't go back to them and say, hey, this was the issue. I would like to talk about being rehired and maybe accommodating for my, you know, possible disability, et cetera. So it certainly may be worth a conversation with them.
Hey, Paul.
Okay. Yep.
You had a double blow getting laid off, finding out you have a health issue. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing very good. I've got a great team I'm working with, scheduling surgery, so I feel comfortable. And minimally invasive surgery, not 95% non-cancerous, so what else can I ask for?
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that, Paul. You can always call Patrick, 312-332-7800. We appreciate the phone call, Paul. Best of luck with you. Patrick, can you explain American Disabilities Act and how that works?
Sure. So any employee with a physical or mental health issue that affects their ability to do their job, that's typically the test, or impacts some part of their life, you have protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and actually the Illinois state law equivalent that requires a company to discuss, if needed, some sort of accommodation to do your job. Maybe if you need different hours to work or the ability to be closer to the bathroom or sit doing your job, whatever it is that allows you to do your job, if the company can accommodate you, it should, under the law, accommodate you. So, and it's also prohibited for the company to discriminate or retaliate against you because of that condition. Or if you bring that up to them, they cannot terminate you or affect any condition of your job. So the ADA is a law that, really importantly, John, we talked about this before, protects folks from mental health struggles, not just physical struggles. I have a lot of clients who come to me who are suffering from anxiety or depression or a whole host of other mental health issues that is really affecting their ability to do their job. And so we work with the company to seek an accommodation that allows them to keep their job and seek the treatment they need and go on, you know, with their job, which is obviously super important. And during that time, also keeping your health insurance. So there's a lot of laws out there that protect folks who are suffering from mental and physical health issues.
Do you think a lot of people are unaware of the rights they have in these situations?
Absolutely. And especially mental health situations. People come to me a lot of times with physical issues, and then they bring up the mental health issues, and they have no idea that they're protected under those laws for their mental health issues as well. And you know, those things can be extremely helpful. Accommodations, you keep your job, you keep your benefits, you keep your pay. All that kind of stuff is obviously super important while you're focusing on the most important thing, which is your mental and physical health, important for you and your family, obviously. So there's a whole host of help out there, and I walk through those issues all the time with folks.
Do you think people should talk to their HR first before they start discussing protections they may be entitled to, or should they talk to a lawyer like you first?
You know what? I think both of them can work. It just depends on the circumstance. If they you know, get along well with HR, if they respect HR and how well they do their job, and most of the times, obviously, HR you know, is very helpful under that circumstance, I think going to the company initially to talk about an accommodation is a good way to go. But I will add, though, that there are so many things that you need to bring up to the company as far as your health condition goes, and a very specific discussion with regard to that condition and how to do your job, that it's also very helpful for me to get involved, to have to walk you know, through that with the employee to say, okay, this is what you do, this is what your health condition is, these are the accommodations that I think you should propose, and help them work through that process. I think both can work, John. The most important thing is that the employee makes the company aware of their individual circumstance and what they need.
And in Paul's case, what made it difficult, but maybe not impossible, was that it may have impacted the situation that led him to get let go. He didn't find out about it till later, but you're saying that potentially, depending on how the circumstances work, even if both parties weren't aware of what was going on, retroactively they could try and do something about it.
Yeah, and then also, yes, John, and then also, we don't know what else was going on with him at that time. Maybe there were symptoms of his condition that, you know, the employer was ignoring, you know, or you know, could see, but then didn't talk with him about. So it didn't have that sort of accommodation discussion. So all these things that, you know, become, you know, uncovered when I start to ask these questions, you know, what were you feeling? Did you say anything? Did folks notice anything? Did they say anything to you? All that kind of stuff can be really helpful to fitting into that legal protection, having
For sure.
that meaningful accommodation discussion.
Patrick Dolan from Conti and Dolan on this Memorial Day Saturday. Patrick, I talked to Karen the other day. I still think she could beat you in an arm wrestling contest. I know you've been working on your guns, though.
I have, especially, you know, when the sun's coming out, John. That's what you have to do.
Let's go to the text line.
Right, you're right, though. I'm not even going to dare try that. I mean, there's no way. That'd be humiliating.
Can you recap? What do you do as an employment lawyer? Who are the people that you help out?
So any workplace or employment-related issue, John, typically those involve, you know, compensation, folks coming into a job. I look at their employment agreement or their offer letter. If you're leaving a job, perhaps we're negotiating a separation agreement, severance money. There's oftentimes, you know, some equity involved, some shares of some sort. There's non-competes involved a lot, as we touched upon earlier, just anything related to coming and going in your job. And also, you know, when you're employed, if you're having issues with your boss, could be discrimination, retaliation, harassment, that kind of stuff, how to handle that. Those are difficult situations.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. Text or call. We love some calls, though, and the phone lines are open right now. Anything weird happening at work to call in about. Great text from the 708. My boss keeps asking when I'm going to retire. I'm 66. What do I tell him, first and foremost? He gives higher increases to the staff who are in their 20s. This sounds like a hot mess, Patrick.
It is, and age discrimination is prevalent. Probably the most often complained about discrimination when I talk to folks. So let's talk about this particular situation. The response to the boss is, when I want to. And stop asking me in the nicest way you can say that. But the fact of the matter is, if you're doing your job well and you like your job and you want to keep your job, there is no reason that you should leave your job because of your age. Very, very few occupations have legitimate, enforceable, mandatory retirement ages. In this person's case, I bet that's not it at all. In the fact that they give increases to folks in their 20s, and remember, John, the line in the sand for age discrimination is 40. If you're over 40 and folks under 40 are treated better in any term or condition of the job, that sets up an age discrimination claim. So there's no reason for you to retire. You shouldn't feel pressured to retire when you don't want to. And if they terminate you, that is exactly the kind of comment you use to support an age discrimination claim.
Do bosses have the right to ask you when are you going to retire? Like maybe once to plan?
Yeah, so they can, but you have to be really careful. You, when I say an employer, have to be really careful about that. Because if you say, I have no plans to retire, and you're terminated, that really is good support for an age discrimination claim. But yes, they can ask, but it shouldn't be like a directive. It should be a question, a legitimate question. When do you plan to retire? Because succession planning, that's legitimate, right? And if somebody said, oh, I'm retiring in a year, and they want to keep their job, the employer wants them to stay, and everything's good, then there's no reason to talk about that any further, and the company has the information it needs to prepare for your departure.
How hard is it to prove claims of either age discrimination or another protected class? Walk us through the evidence that you're looking for and how this case would work.
Yeah, so age, I think, is particularly difficult because oftentimes it, you know, may not be as overt, and the law sets a little bit of a higher bar in terms of evidence. So let's talk about what you need. First of all, if someone, as I said before, is younger than 40 and treated better than you in any term or condition, that could support a claim. Comments about your age, comments about your ability to do your job that reflect a physical characteristic, a mental characteristic that is typically associated with age, that could be evidence of age discrimination. Oftentimes, John, it's a combination of a bunch of things. It's comments from the boss. It's comments from your coworkers about, are you sure you can do that, Grandpa? That ladder's kind of high, you know, something like that. And you put it together with the fact that younger folks who treated better, that supports an age claim. But you really have to look at the full picture. And a couple of comments here and there, frankly, is probably not going to get you the support you need for a good age claim. You have to, you know, it has to be more substantive than that.
Is it easier if you've got multiple people claiming the same thing?
Yes, it is. Because then what you have is an institutional problem on behalf of the employer who is, and, you know, a group who is subject to the same sort of illegal treatment is more impactful than an individual typically. So I do ask when I'm talking to somebody about any discrimination, you know, do you know other folks who were treated the same? And frankly, when I talk to, you know, female employees, they often say, oh, yeah, I know two or three other women who were mistreated the same way I was by that boss, or because of the pay level that we're all at, it's less than the pay for men or something like that. So when you start asking the questions, the evidence tends to just come out to support what they're saying happened to them.
708 followed up, my boss has already offered my job to a younger staff member. I'm in accounting. Like, almost like, hey, this person's going to replace you. That seems real squirrely.
It is really squirrely, and that's not unusual. And they may not say anything to you until you're fired, and then they'll come, you know, maybe the company comes up with an excuse that you don't think is legitimate at all about your performance. You haven't heard anything about your performance until now. And so that raises a bunch of questions. And then you're replaced by somebody under 40. That's pretty good evidence of age discrimination, John.
It's weird having a line. I know they have to have an age line, but if they replace you with someone who turns 40 that day, it immediately makes your claim worse than if they had been 39 and 355 days, right?
Yeah, I know. I guess the line has to be somewhere. And I will say, like, for someone who's 70 and replaced by somebody who's like 41, there is some law that protects an individual under that circumstance, but that's sort of a slippery slope, and I don't like to, you know, it really depends on the circumstance, and that's unusual. But, you know, if it's age-based discrimination, then that could support a claim, as well as you being replaced by somebody under 40 if you're over 40. That is by far the majority of the cases and the strongest place to be.
Right. You don't need both. You can be pushed out because of your age and you have a case, regardless of who replaces you, right?
That's correct. Although it's frankly a lot easier under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act if the person replacing you is under 40. I'll say that. Like, if you're 49 and the person replacing you is 43, that's not going to get you there. But as I said, if you're 70 and the person replacing you is 41, that's probably enough, but not nearly as good as if the person's 39 replacing you.
Two more months till I'm in that class, Patrick. I'm excited.
Good for you, John. There is a benefit of being an old man.
708 says he or she followed up again. I also have a physical disability. This is the type of person that needs to call you.
Yeah, this is. And that's a whole other set of issues that, you know, they could be protected because of that. And certainly the combination, that's not an unusual combination, set of circumstances at all. An age issue and a physical accommodation issue. And the company may look at that and say, you can't do your job anymore. But what they're ignoring is the whole reasonable accommodation discussion. Okay, that's what has to happen. I'm happy to talk with them.
Patrick, I did want to give you a chance. You mentioned to me that you wanted to talk about a Memorial Day and a tribute to an RV serviceman. Why don't we make sure we get that in?
Yeah, thanks, John. So his name was Robert J. Murphy, and he was from the south side of Chicago. He went over and served in Vietnam for a couple of years, came back, found his way to my dad's research lab at Loyola University in Chicago. My dad gave him a job, got him into Loyola. He stayed there for undergrad, stayed there from medical school, went out to Los Angeles, became a very famous anesthesiologist. And actually, he was in the movie E.T. John, if you remember the scene where E.T. is in that bubble and their doctor's taking care of him, well, Dr. Robert J. Murphy was there taking care of E.T. in the film. Huh. He had a daughter. Unfortunately, he developed cancer a few years later and died as a result of that cancer. And I just want to pay a tribute to Dr. Murphy, his family, and all the servicemen and women who have not returned or returned with physical or, you know, mental health issues, and their families and loved ones are taking care of them, you know, the best way they can. Now, the folks who are left behind, as I saw in Dr. Murphy's young daughter, really struggled for years overcoming that. And I just want all of us to think about the servicemen and women and their families who have done so much for this country. And my heart went out to Murph, as we called him, and his wife and daughter, who I moved out to L.A. to help raise for a while. Just very meaningful folks, and pay tribute to him and all the other servicemen and women.
Well said, Patrick, and I agree with all of that and what you said. Important to tell those stories this weekend, particularly, too. Back to the text line, the 312 says, as an employer, it sounds as if this gentleman is of no use to an employer. I don't mean to insult you, Patrick, and I don't think the texter is trying to do that. You fight for employees, but you do work for employers, too.
I do. Yes, I know I do. My clients are both companies and employees, but, you know, who I talk to the most are employees, and there are circumstances where, frankly, the company has obligations, especially in terms of accommodation issues and discussions with older folks and their ability to do the job, that, you know, sometimes companies fall short. And so, to me, it's a reminder. I'd say most companies do the right thing, and the HR folks do the right thing, and the company owners do the right thing, but certainly sometimes they don't. And, you know, that's why I'm here to help folks with those issues, but also companies, to help them with what they need to do and what they should do under circumstances, under those circumstances.
Interesting. I'm getting a text from the 630. I'm trying to follow up, Patrick, to get quick answers. 630 can call in, too. They say that they work in a staffing agency in sales, and they took more commissions out of their PTO, or took out more commissions because of the new PTO laws. We were not aware of it, and it started in January. Have you heard of anything like this?
No, that's strange to me. And I'm really happy to talk with them. I mean, the new PTO law should not, paid time off laws in Illinois and Chicago, should not negatively affect that. So I'm really happy to talk with them in more detail about that.
Yeah, that wouldn't make sense. Why would commissions go away unless they're saying, well, we need to pay more to have people have days off? I guess an employer could make concessions to try and, like, say, hey, you're all getting a raise of a dollar because we have to cover people more when they're sick. I don't know. That seems squirrely to me.
Yeah. No, it does, especially if they're trying to change a part of a commission plan retroactively. That is to say, you know, have it start earlier than folks are provided notice of.
We get a lot of questions about commission. That happens sometimes where commissions are doled out in different schedules. Someone's laid off or something happens. They don't get their entire commissions. And that's where you can step in, too.
Yeah, I have a lot of commission questions. And it all starts with the plan, right? What does the plan say? But Illinois law is pretty favorable to employees when it comes to commissions. Those are usually earned compensation rights. And so I look at the plan, talk through the issues. But, you know, sales commissions can be really complicated, especially when someone's leaving what you have the right to. And so we really have to unpack a lot of issues there. And there's a lot to talk about.
We've also had people call, say they're laid off and aren't given their last paycheck or something. All of that is illegal. It makes you wonder why an employer would even try it, but sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do. And, you know, sometimes the commission plan gets an interpretation by a company that is not reasonable. But sometimes the company is generous, too. And the thing about commission plans, John, is a lot of them are sort of ambiguous, right? Because they it's hard to cover every different scenario and circumstance, but they really need to. The most important one is, when is that commission earned? When do you have the right to those monies? And that's the thing that I look at first. What does the policy say on that? And we go from there.
Patrick, got about a minute or so left. Let us know give us the whole rundown. Who should be calling you and why?
So employers too, sure. Or employees, you know, independent contractors, part-time employees, anyone with questions or issues regarding the workplace or their job, I'm happy to talk to them. John, as you know, I field a lot of calls from WGN listeners and others who just have questions, you know, and they want to know if this is illegal, you know, what should they do in this circumstance? Should they talk to their boss or HR? Or, you know, HR wants this information from them. Should they provide it? Anything to do with a workplace issue, and it can just literally be a question. I'm happy to talk to folks just so they know what they need to know to keep their job and be happy in their job and be productive.
Right. I'm sure some listeners have called you. You've talked them through, and you just say, well, I don't think you have a case. I'm sorry. But that at least gives them some peace of mind.
It does. And at the end of the call, they seem a lot better than when we started because they really feel better just knowing.
And you don't charge for that little chat, right?
No. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I just want people to know that because have this perception.
No, people can call me. I'm happy to talk with them. If it goes somewhere, then we can talk about that. But no, not at the beginning.
The TV and the movies make it seem like the moment you start talking, there's a stopwatch and a bill that comes afterwards.
Nope. Not with me, at least. Nope.
And neither with Karen as well. Patrick Dolan, right, Conti sure. and Dolan Law, 312-332-7800. Patrick, have a great rest of the weekend, okay?
Thanks, John.